we were so excited to have a company and be buying golf courses that, and we were so new to it that maybe the focus areas for our acquisitions were different than they are today. You know, meaning the business modeling that we do today is just, it's so much more refined than what we were doing in 2011, 2012, 2013. It, you know, if something had a decent layout and we felt good about it, we bought it.
My name is Matt Bros with Locked In, and I have been so fortunate in my life to be surrounded by some really awesome people. So I want to be able to get their stories out there so that we can all learn from them together. Welcome to the Excellence Culture.
Well, welcome the Excellence Culture. Man, this is obviously a different setting than y'all are used to, but I get to sit down with a good friend and talk about his story. I want to introduce you to John Brown, Great Life Golf Group. Mm-hmm. Group? Is there a group at the end there?
Not really.
Just Great Life Golf.
Yeah, simple.
A golf management company that owns and manages golf courses all around the country. And many of you know, but golf is a big part of my life. Working with golf courses is a big part of what I do for my job. And so John and I have gotten to know each other through that. So mm-hmm. I appreciate you being on and having me here to your hood. This is their headquarters here. And
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania.
Gosh,
I never thought you'd be here, huh?
Yeah, I know. It was a journey to get here a little bit, but
yeah.
I like it.
Yeah,
like
direct flight though.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a direct flight. Got in at 10:30 at night though.
Yeah.
So
sorry.
Yeah. It's all right. But man, yeah, I appreciate it. And he's kind of watched a couple of these videos that we do, and you've got a great team here helping us set this up. And really what I like to do is just kind of hear people's stories and let us all learn from it. Mm-hmm. And I think that story can have some personal side to it. That story is going to have a lot of business side to it. See how they all mesh together, and just really learn kind of what makes you tick a little bit, which would be really cool. So, and I think it's always best to just, let's go back to, and I say this every time, Little John.
Yeah.
What was Little John like? What was your upbringing like? Maybe you can just go from there.
Sure. I grew up in Pennsylvania, central Pennsylvania. Parents actually got divorced when I was younger, so I actually grew up during the school year in a single parent household, which obviously had an impact on my life. But in the summer times, I would actually go and I'd live with my father, who was a head golf professional. So I kind of had a little bit of this dual upbringing, lived in two different areas. In the summer times, I'd be around the golf business. He was either a head golf professional or a general manager, and I'd live with him. I'd play a lot of golf, play junior golf, obviously. Loved the game. And then during the school year, I would live in central PA with my mom, who was the executive director of Carlisle YMCA. Okay. And so I played youth sports, grew up in a single parent home while I was in elementary school with my brother Todd. And, to be honest, I look back on it very fondly. I kind of got the opportunity to live in sort of two different environments, get comfortable in two different environments. And, I look back, with a lot of joy on just the experiences I had overall. And, I'm fond of where I'm from.
Yeah. So what age were you when that separation kind of happened?
6 years old.
Okay.
I was 6 years old. And my mother got remarried when I was 11. So it's basically kindergarten through fifth grade.
Okay.
Was when it was just my mom and my brother Todd and I.
Okay.
And then my parents maintained a good relationship as far as co-parenting, but a little bit unique in the sense that obviously my parents eventually lived in different areas. Yeah. So I'd live in two different spots.
Yeah. Well, so it sounds like your summers, you almost had like your golf camp in the summers with your dad, huh?
Absolutely. Yeah. When I was, from the time I was about 6 to 11, he still lived in the same area I lived. Really, when I was about 12 years old is when he was in different markets. And that was about the age where I started working in golf too. So I'd I'd work the bag drop and eventually work my way into the shop. So I'd go and I'd work the open one or two shift, then right out the practice, right out the play 18 or 27, go to sleep, wake up, do the same thing the next morning.
Yeah. And you went in to play high school golf, right?
Yep.
All the way through high school.
Played golf. High school golf, played college golf.
Where'd you play college golf?
I played for a year at Hofstra University, which was a Division I school in Long Island, New York. Okay. And then 3 years at a Division II school, Westchester University, just outside of Philadelphia.
Okay.
Yep.
That's awesome, man. Yep. So what I love so much about these, because so often we don't really sit down and really talk about that upbringing we had, really some of the things that make us tick the way we are today.
Yep.
So that's all stuff that I didn't know.
Yeah.
So it's cool, man. Yeah. That's cool. Okay. So college, where would you say your mindset was in college related to, you know, maybe what you might do in the future?
Well, when I was, you know, in high school, I led a lot of the junior camps, and I did junior instruction with my father, who was a head professional. And I knew pretty early on that I just didn't have the patience for teaching. Yeah. I think it's a great discipline for those folks that do have the patience, but you probably know me well enough. You could see that maybe, yeah. But so I kind of, you know, and golf at that point, if you're going to be a head golf professional, you know, really was tied to an interest in teaching. So yeah. I sort of knew that maybe being a golf professional wasn't going to be the direction that I wanted to go. Went to college. I ended up graduating with a finance degree. So it was all business and finance classes. I was always numbers oriented, and I just like business in general. So I was attracted to the idea of business and, you know, how you look at, you know, not just the golf business, but any business, and how you make it more efficient, and, you know, how there might be a return there. And that attracted me. And so I worked in banking for a couple of years during college, which led into my first job out of school. I was a commercial loan underwriter for Wells Fargo for a couple of years. So it's really numbers driven.
That's probably a really good understanding to have, though, going into the role that you have.
It was an excellent, entry level position where what I did was approved auto loans. And this was, you know, pre, you know, the mortgage crisis. So yeah. There were subprime loans or 20% rates out there everywhere. And Wells Fargo was kind of known as the bank where, you know, people with, you know, some sketchy credit could still get an auto loan. Right. And we would negotiate with the finance managers, try to secure those loans for the bank. And I learned a lot about default rates. I learned a lot about exposure risk, negotiation tactics with finance managers. I also learned that, you know, maybe the industry itself wasn't exactly transparent. You know, there was an opportunity back in those days where you could essentially buy the rates up, which what that meant is our bank could approve a rate of 8%. And if the finance manager could turn around and sell that rate to the customer for 9%, they'd make the delta. And I always felt very sticky about that. You know, I didn't like that. I started to get rooted in maybe is this the right, you know, moral makeup for me in that situation. So, you know, that's probably where I started asking questions, I'd say.
Yeah. Well, that explains so much. And we're going to get into a little bit later. But I would consider you like a high justice person. Like you certainly understand revenue and you know that your organization's got to make money. But you want to make money the right way. And from what you're doing with some of the other enterprises outside of even the golf management company, I would say is a high justice endeavor, which is really cool and a great characteristic to have. So, so you're outside of college, you're getting kind of into this first time of career mode. And so then we're going to start moving into, you know, where does the golf world come back into your life?
Yeah, actually, I visited my father in Phoenix, Arizona. He was the general manager of a Troon golf facility, Moon Valley Country Club. And it was just me visiting him like when I was about 24 years old. And I met the membership director of the club out at his golf course. And we went out, we played a round of golf. I think he invited me out to a Coyotes game that night, where he was taking a couple of membership prospects to the Coyotes game. So we went to the Coyotes game with a couple of membership prospects. And
that's kind of fun.
Yeah, we like just socialized and had a good time and watched the game. And like the next morning I was like, I feel like I would be pretty good at this particular position if it was ever available. And I came back to the East Coast. I was in Philadelphia at the time working for Wells Fargo. I could kind of see some of the default rates climbing. I could almost envision what may be on the horizon for, you know, subprime mortgages and auto loans to some degree. This is about 2006, late 2006. And I started looking for membership director jobs. And I found one at a wonderful 18-hole private Jack Nicklaus signature course in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, called the Peninsula Golf and Country Club. I applied, and when I was 24 years old, I got the job. And, you know, the rest is history as far as entering the golf world. But I entered it, you know, not through a golf professional channel, through a membership director channel, which was, you know, where my interest lied.
Yeah. Okay. And then at some point, is the next step kind of you starting to work with your dad again?
So that was 24 years old. It was a Troon property. I was in Delaware. He was in Arizona at the time. And I worked for Troon probably for 6 years between, I was a membership director at the Peninsula Golf and Country Club. I did some membership director work at Concord Country Club, which was in Philadelphia, and then worked my way to a club in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which is when the opportunity to start Brown Golf with my father came about in October of 2010.
Okay. So I'm going to backtrack a little bit. So from a personality standpoint, I'm interested in this. When you were that membership director, were you able to stay in your lane, or were you already in this place where you're seeing, I want to solve this, I want to solve this, even if it wasn't a membership, you know, focus thing?
Ah, that's a great question. I'm pretty sure I wasn't able to stay in my lane.
Yeah, yeah.
But I would say that the lane that I had as far as a membership director, you know, I was very focused on being the best membership director I could be, meaning following up on every single lead, learning about the customer, developing a relationship, you know, working those leads to a point of understanding that, yes, they are going to become a member, or no, they're not, and I know exactly why they're not. And you do it in a friendly way. You're not selling. You're just providing information and getting to an end point, right? And, you know, I was very committed to that, but I definitely started to see other opportunities, you know, in the club environment. Yeah. From a business standpoint, okay. For sure.
I've just found like a lot of organizations, they like people who stay in their lane, but then leaders of organizations don't stay in their lane, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's a really interesting thing as you're thinking about developing people, is just that concept of staying in a lane. Because it sounds like perfect timing for you to go work with your dad, because you didn't have to probably stay in a lane there. Mm-hmm. So let's kind of get into that part of your life of getting to work with your dad again.
Yeah. Yeah. It was October of 2010. He was an owner. At this point, he was the general manager of a club called St. James Plantation, which is 81 hole golf community, just about 30 minutes south of Wilmington, North Carolina. He owned 1/11th of a 27 hole facility outside the gates, about 20 minutes outside the gates.
1/11th.
Yeah, 1/11th.
And then he's an 81.
Well, then he was the GM of the 81 hole, which was
odd numbers.
Which was the Troon property.
Yeah.
But he had put together this investment group, and they bought a 27 hole facility, which he owned 1/11th in at the time. And he got a call from an old contact who said that he worked for a gentleman who had interest in the golf business, and he wanted to come down and see the facility that my dad had bought with these other 10 folks. So he called me, and I was working for Troon at the time. And he said, you know, I'd like you to come down. You know, I just got a feeling about this meeting. And I said, oh, okay. I said, well, why? And he's like, I don't know. I just have a feeling. I was like, okay, I'll fly down for your feeling. You know, it's like October. That's a nice time to be in North Carolina. I said, I'll come down, play around the golf, meet this gentleman, you know, see where it goes. So we toured the facility there, which was called Magnolia Greens, for about 45 minutes. And then we sat in a room for about 30 to 40 minutes. The gentleman who came down, his name was Joe Topper. He asked us, peppered us with questions for about 40 minutes. And at the end of the 40 minutes, he said, you know, I'm really interested in buying golf courses. You know, how do I build a company with the two of you to go out and start buying golf courses? And, you know, that was a very, you know, that was a 30,000 foot question that had, you know, a lot to it, right? So we had to kind of map our way out what that looked like. But that was in October of 2010. And over the next 90 days, we constructed a business model. And in January of 2011, we started Brown Golf. And basically, we became employees of Joe's company. He was our venture capital partner. And we were the golf acquisition arm, essentially, for Joe. And we would go out and we bought our first club in March of that year of 2011, our second one in May. And then we added
That first club?
Pinecrest Golf Club in Bluffton, okay. South Carolina. Island West was the second one in Bluffton, South Carolina, which is where my dad was located living at the time. He had moved from St. James when we started Brown Golf to Bluffton, and he bought those two clubs. And then our first two management deals were in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, which is where I was located. So we kind of grew out of the epicenters of where we were located. And then by the end of the first year, sort of renegotiated the deal to what it currently or what it has been, which is Joe would own the land and we would have long-term business leases on the golf properties. And so we started building Brown Golf from there.
Okay. So that's 2011, mm-hmm. you know, through that decade, basically. Tell me about during that period of time. I think, how many courses did you get up to in the Brown Golf era?
From January of 11 till I bought my dad out, which would have been September of 17, it was 30 golf courses, 25 locations.
Okay. So, you know, 30 golf courses, 25 locations, roughly probably, 300 full-time employees, 250 full-time employees or so, I bet.
Yeah.
You know, in that time, what do you think were the biggest challenges that kind of kept you up at night, you know?
Yeah, the I would say we were so excited to have a company and be buying golf courses that and we were so new to it that maybe the focus areas for our acquisitions were different than they are today, you know, meaning the business modeling that we do today is just, it's so much more refined than what we were doing in 2011, yeah. 2012, 2013. It, you know, if something had a decent layout and we felt good about it, we bought it. And, you know, so we bought some clubs that were underperformers, right? But you're in this lease model. You better figure out how to make it work, right? So, you know, January of 11 till, you know, the end of 15, you know, we were pretty much a break-even company, right? So I would just say the ebbs and flows of cash flow, because golf's such a cash-intensive business. We didn't own the real estate. And, you know, we didn't have a very specific strategy for the properties we were bringing on. So we were learning as we go.
Yeah. And then when did kids start to get in the picture?
Probably for me?
Mid-2006, or when did you have your first child?
So my wife and I have been together since we were 16.
Okay.
So that's we awesome. Got married when we were 23. And then I had my first my first daughter when I was 25, and my wife was 24. So she's going to be 16 here real soon. So she's born 2008, so a few years before Brown Golf got started. And then I've added a second and a third since. So I've got an 11-year-old and a 6-year-old since. So, starting a new company, leaving Troon at the time for this business idea in January 2011, when you have a toddler at the house, is an interesting conversation with your wife. But but she supported me and
probably risky financially, but you also had a lot of autonomy, right? You weren't
sure, but autonomy with probably not quite the depth of experience I needed at the time, right? So, but obviously, it's all added to the toolbox, for me now. But I mean, it was a great time. It was fun. It was exciting. It was a little scary. It was all those things.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so fast forward. I'd love to kind of hear about the dynamics and, share as much as you want, but just the process of buying the assets from your father.
Mm-hmm.
Was your dad's name John too?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, cool.
Yep.
Buying the assets from John. And was that a hard process to go through, easy process, peaceful process? Like,
sure. Yeah. So it happened two times because my brother Todd was also part of the company as well. Okay. He was 2 years younger than me. So I bought my father out in 17 and my brother Todd in 19. Okay. It was a difficult process. I don't know how else to say it. I mean, just, you know, you're talking about money. There's family dynamics at play. You know, there's the responsibility of whoever is buying out the members that are leaving is then burdened with, you know, those decisions and having to pay back that money. So, like, obviously there's, you know, anytime you sell something, you want to get as much value as possible. Anytime you buy something, it's your responsibility, right? It's just those dynamics at play and pool. But no, it was stressful for sure.
Yeah.
It was a challenge.
Yeah. I bet. And what's your dad doing now?
He's the director of instruction at our 54-hole resort in Orlando. So I would say back to his roots.
So he's working for you?
Yeah, well, kind of. He's an independent contractor, okay. But he's still an entrepreneur, that's right? Awesome, so he's an independent contractor. But he is at Orange Lake and master PGA professional by trade. And he was always very good at the patience with teaching the golf swing. And frankly, I think it's the best fit for his personality and what he can do for folks. So he kind of went, you know, from that world into, you know, general manager and then into management company and now back into that world again.
So. Yeah. And I consider you view him as a mentor to, like, what's something that you think when you think of your dad, that one thing that you felt like you learned the most from him?
Interpersonal skills. You know, he was always good at shaking somebody's hand, looking them in the eye, kind of pulling them in a little bit, you know, cool. Just a little different touch with how he interrelated to, you know, folks in that way. I would say my mom, who was a single mother, executive director of the Carlisle YMCA, she kind of brought the grit a little bit, you know, because, you know, when you're a single parent, you have two sons at home. And, you know, at the time when my parents got divorced, she was an aerobics instructor and she worked her way into the executive director.
Wow.
You know, that doesn't happen by accident. So I would say a little bit of that grit and determination probably comes from her.
Yeah.
So, you know, that combination from both.
Yeah, that's cool. Any other mentors kind of that you can think of in your upbringing? Or,
you know, I would say one of the – I don't know how to say it outside of just saying I wish I had a little bit more opportunity for deeper, stronger mentor relationships. Yeah. I feel like that's been a little bit of a void in our space, in our industry. You know, David Pillsbury, who runs Invited Golf, I would say out of all the folks that have been around a long time, is the most open to have conversations and be honest about sort of his business path. And, you know, if I had a question, I know I could call him and ask him, which I appreciate. But I do envision in the future, I hope that, you know, I'm a little bit more approachable than maybe where the industry has historically been. It's felt like a little bit of a void, to be honest there. So I guess there's some benefit in that as well. You got to figure it out on your own to some degree, which, you know, you learn from the positives and you learn and move past the negatives. So that's where that falls.
Yeah. Well, I would say that you are approachable, and I bet there's some young operator out there that would love to get some of your wisdom. So So now we're 2017 and we're, you know, going into, you know, you becoming full owner, but then there is COVID happens 2020.
Yep.
Okay. Tell me what's going on in your mind and, you know, fast forward, we know it was a good thing for golf kind of, right? Yep. But, what was going on in your mind when that whole world just went crazy?
So March, April, May, sort of sheer panic, to be honest, because we weren't a third-party management company with our focus, right? We own the profit and loss of the golf courses.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we lost $4 million of revenue year over year in 20 at the facilities that we have long-term leases on in those 3 months compared to 2019, right? You just don't get past that type of hit when you're an organization of our size, right? And it was, I was really worried. We had to lay a couple folks off. We had to skinny down, you know, our operations. Every single state had different, you know, rules around golf, you know, how you could play golf, some single rider cart, some 15 minute tea time intervals, some 50% capacity in the restaurant. You know, it was just, and you had to stay on top of all these rules. And it was kind of like, who's really, we know who's mandating the rules, but who's monitoring sort of, you know, if you're following. And it was, you know, very unprecedented time for sure. Obviously, it turned into a huge blessing. And, you know, to our country's credit, the PPP loan saved Brown Golf. Yeah. I mean, we retained most of our workforce. The owners went without salaries for, you know, quite a bit of time, and we got through it. But the PPP loan really saved, you know, our business. And frankly, is one of the times I would say that I saw sort of a sophisticated government react and save, you know, a business like ours and all of our employees. And it did help.
Yeah, that was I'm glad you said that. That was a really good example of, you know, it was good to be an American at that point, and they were doing the right things.
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes you hear folks go on their rants about sort of the United States and governments and politics, and there's definitely enough to rant about. But at the end of the day, that crisis and that program saved a lot of businesses of our size, which helped a lot of people.
Well, that's good. Okay, so now we can kind of, you're not called Brown Golf anymore.
Nope.
You're called Great Life Golf.
Yep.
And I actually think Great Life Golf is a great name.
So do I.
And so tell me about that journey, man. Where'd that start?
Started 8 years before the merger happened. So the merger was September of 2022. Jason Harshbarger, my partner CFO, met Rick Ferrant, one of the owners on the Great Life side, at an industry event, played golf. I forget which event it was, Golf Inc. or Golf Business, one of those events. Yeah. They played golf, kind of struck up a friendship, stayed in contact. And over time, you know, there were some conversations about business, but really it's more about networking and just having a professional relationship. And then when the time came and Rick and his partners were looking for, you know, maybe a little bit more of a strategic setup with a golf partner, he followed us over the years. He contacted us and some great conversations ensued. I think we had a really strong idea of what we wanted from a Brown Golf side. At the time, there were three owners, myself, my CFO, Jason Harshbarger, and then our third partner, Lee Arroyo. And they had three partners. So it was a little bit synergistic in the sense that there were three of us, there were three of them, and the inputs of what they wanted, which was, you know, they wanted a golf management company to come in and run their assets, but they wanted to continue to be introduced to new investment opportunities in golf. That coupled with what we wanted, you know, a larger geographic footprint, the opportunity to make more of an impact, and then obviously some new partners, some new capital go out and to continue to add properties. It was a really good fit, but I would also say, you know, you never know till you're in the marriage how it's going to manifest. And in since September of 22 till today, I mean, I've been really pleased with the partnership and the relationship, and I wouldn't have changed anything.
That's awesome. Great Life Golf is a thing now. Brown Golf, Great Life Golf is together. Mm-hmm. How many clubs were there at that point?
We both had about 25 golf courses at that time, and we're at 55 today.
Okay. So you've had some acquisitions since then.
Mm-hmm.
Is Carolina National one of those?
Yep.
That is since then? Yep. I know that's a pretty...
Well, Carolina National we bought right... No, we bought before the merger. Okay. But obviously it was part of the merger, yes.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, now we're a pretty big organization, right? Mm-hmm. And you've probably got large organization problems. I'd love to kind of start getting into your mind around the people side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because I walk into this place here, your headquarters, and I really do notice like joy in this place. People enjoy their job. That's something to not take for granted. But I'd like to hear about just some of the things that you think about from a people side, maybe even a culture side for your organization, and maybe any kind of tricks of the trade that you guys might have.
Sure. I think talent is probably the most undervalued asset at any company, right?
Yeah.
And it's the layers of talent you can add and then how they work together to achieve results that an individual couldn't, right? And that I do believe in that. And so if I see, you know, an opportunity, you know, to bring somebody in, like a perfect example is, you know, Bryce Voisin, who's our director of revenue, somebody that I worked with whenever he worked for a company called Dynamic Revenue Services. They did dynamic pricing in golf. And I could just tell sort of his knowledge base in the tee sheet management landscape and dynamic pricing and the strategies there. And that kind of stuck with me. And when the opportunity presented itself in our organization to maybe look a little differently at our executive level layer, he was a great call and added a much different level of sophistication in that discipline. Yeah. And so, you know, I think I've tried to add unique perspectives and backgrounds. But I do think from a culture standpoint, there's got to be a little bit of connectivity amongst the people in the office. And yeah, frankly, you know, and, you know, I've heard, you've heard of professional sports, the coach and the star athlete don't have to like each other. I don't know if that works in the business world as well. You know what I mean? I think in professional sports that might work. But in this world, I think you do have to have a little bit of camaraderie and you do have to like each other to some degree. You don't have to be best friends. You don't have to go out to dinner every weekend. But, I mean, at least in this office, I know a lot of our folks do like each other and they do have an affinity for golf, which obviously, you know, is nice because we're a golf company. But, you know, genuinely good people obviously are folks you want to be around. But I would just say that anybody who works hard and invests in themselves, you just never know when that opportunity is going to present itself. And I try to add those folks to our organization.
Yeah. I remember when I was the general manager at a club, this was a long time ago. This was like 15 years ago. But I felt like as the general manager, I felt this burden to help these young kids who are maybe in the cart barn or, you know, maybe in the snack shop, to realize that what they're doing right now in this first job that they're having in life can set the tone for the worker that you're going to be, you know, for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. And so even though you might be getting paid $8 an hour right now, it matters to who you're going to be down the road. Do you kind of see that? Like, do you think your managers are kind of aware of that? And
well, I think it's I think when you hire somebody into their first job, you could see inroads into their interpersonal skills and their work ethic, which I think translate throughout life, right?
Yeah.
I would agree with that without a doubt. I think at a certain level, you know, the burden of responsibility becomes part of your position as well, right? And for an organization to achieve results, there also has to be accountability and sometimes directness too. So, you know, there's the balancing act of creating the right culture and having a fun working environment, but also being productive. Yeah. And so what I'm proud of in our organization is that, I mean, I would think if you'd ask most of our employees off camera, they say, yeah, generally John's a nice guy.
Yep.
He means well, but he'll be direct. Like, you know, if we need to get something done. And I think, you know, you have to be that way. And frankly, I want to see that out of my managers as well. And, you know, and I also want to empower those folks not to be scared to make a decision. I'd rather they make a decision, screw it up, and we talk about it than be afraid and paralyzed to make a decision, because the only way we're really going to get anywhere is to get to that point, make a decision, learn, grow, and move forward. So I'm much more of the opinion, make a decision off the information you have, believe in it, and if it's not the right decision, we'll learn from it.
Yeah.
If you did 1, 2, and 3, I'll be okay if it's a mistake.
Yeah.
You know,
you got to have some hard conversations at times, right?
Once in a while, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so I want to get into this high justice of John Brown, okay? And you had kind of briefly talked about Bryce, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who's involved in something called Golf Back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of want to get in your brain around the why of that, kind of what started that why, and go from there.
Sure. So golf management company, Brown Golf, Great Life Golf, golf management company, right?
Yeah.
Acquisitions, leases, third-party manage. None of that says golf technology, yet we have a golf technology company, Golfback, which has approximately 115 clients today. And that company purely was built out of a solution needed in the marketplace. And, you know, the golf technology landscape offered point of sale technology and what they call distribution technology. So where a place where you'd put aggregate tee time, so a bunch of tee times from a bunch of different golf courses in one place where golfers could buy tee time. So golfnow.com, teeoff.com, their aggregate distribution solutions. And their networks became so powerful because of how many golf courses they had and the data they were collecting from those golfers that it felt like in the marketplace that you had to work with them. And the pricing model and the relationship model really tilted away from course owners and operators. And basically they dictated terms to, you know, course owners and operators who frankly bear the burden of all the risk associated with owning golf course property, right? And unfortunately, you know, I just felt like I couldn't find a fair solution in the marketplace that was committed to some core principles. And what I did is we built a online booking engine technology, GolfBack, which was rooted in those principles. And the principles were simple. The golf course owns the data. Golf course controls its lowest price in the marketplace. The golf course becomes the direct communicator to its customer. And the golf course retains 100% of its online green and card fee revenue. And that became sort of our focus inside Brown Golf at the time, but really inside our market as a whole, right? Protect these core principles and the industry will flourish as a result. And we've created a bit of a movement with that technology and it's installed at all of our Great Life facilities. And it's just the counterpunch to what I thought was a relationship that was highly tilted away from the folks that own and operate golf courses. And so, I mean, we're proud of it and we believe in it. And it's basically a direct solution, right? It's golf course and golf course inventory tee times being sold directly to customers, you know, no middle person in between.
Yeah. So when you want to start something like that, you know, getting more into your entrepreneurial mind, I mean, you're figuring out the technology piece, you're figuring out the revenue piece, there's all these things, the people piece of it. Did it seem clear pretty quick? Like, I know that this is needed and I know I can do it. Or what was the due diligence that kind of happened for you to finally say, yeah, we're going to do this?
Once I got comfortable with my non-negotiables or my core principles, it was much easier for me to hone in on what to do and how to do it.
Yeah.
And really, it came down to, well, the only way to control and own those four core principles was you needed the point where a consumer sees golf tee times that are for sale. So you need to control the online booking engine, right?
Yeah.
And then from there, I mean, we got very comfortable with that. The brand of golf is just bought differently. If you're going to go to a convention or conference in a city, you want to see a menu of hotel options around that conference. That makes sense, right? But if you're going to go play golf in a city, my guess is you probably already know the courses in the marketplace, or at least the type and level of golf course, the brand. Mm-hmm. And we got very comfortable with folks, you know, they don't need an aggregate menu of options. What they need is they're smart enough to understand what the brands are in the marketplace, and they're going to go find the value for themselves, right? So just house that value on your golf course website where you control that relationship with that consumer.
Yeah.
And that's really how it evolved.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And I can only imagine the value that that creates in the management side for what you guys do too, with the properties that you own, the properties that you manage. I mean, I feel like they're very symbiotic. How about from your leadership standpoint? Like, do you have to put on one hat and then the other, or do you feel like you're able to kind of wear both hats and,
I feel like I can wear both hats because I feel like GolfBack was built by a course owner because it was, right?
Yeah.
And it's built around the same core principles. So anything I believe on the golf technology side, I believe on the golf course ownership side. So, you know, I feel like I can wear both hats. And it, you know, the tools evolved. You know, now because all your tee times are housed in a booking engine that you own on your golf course website, obviously, you can collect all your customers' data. You can optimize your revenue, but you can also provide great value to customers in the tee times that make sense. So you can build that relationship. And it's really morphed into a full-blown automated marketing tool where you just create that ongoing relationship. In a perfect world, in the industry, if everybody own their relationship. They knew every single customer that played golf at their golf course, and they were able to market to them through automation on the points that they were interested in, the industry would be better as a whole.
Yeah, seems more fair, better. Nobody's getting taken advantage of.
Correct.
So that's really good, man. So I would love to hear kind of state of the golf industry right now, in your opinion. And when we say golf industry, we're more talking about the golf course industry. Mm-hmm. So state of the industry right now, and then I'll ask you more of the future in a little bit. But
sure. Well, there's kind of different channels to that, right? So if we just go based off of golf participation, we got a huge boom from COVID. 21, 22 was a fantastic year. 23, we all saw just a little bit of a tick back in rounds overall. But, you know, the supply of golf courses has been shrinking since 2006, right? So more golf courses have closed than opened every year since 2006. So all the golf courses...
You don't hear about a whole lot of new courses.
No, the new ones that are being built are destination, really high-end resorts. Yeah. But, you know, really the golf course supply is not going to grow. You're not going to see, just because of the cost to build a new golf course, is just so much higher than, you know, what you can go out and buy a golf course for on the marketplace. But what we do have is we have this layer of golfer which never existed before. So you have about 26 million golfers playing green grass golf. You have 15 million playing off course golf, simulator golf, Top Golf, Top Tracer. I mean, this customer base didn't exist, you know, 10 years ago, right? The average age of the green grass golfer is about 46. The average age of the off-course golfer is 31. It's a pipeline that didn't exist. You know, we had approximately the same amount of golfers, 23, 24 million 10 years ago, right? We have about 25, 26 million today. We didn't have the 15 million 10 years ago. We do now have the 15 million now, which is a great feeder system for the future of additional golfers and rounds. Yeah. So that's really exciting from the future of the game. And we may not do the same rounds we did the year right after COVID, but we're going to be close, right? Yeah. And this feeder system is a great system. As far as, you know, the golf landscape as a whole, about 16% of golf courses are managed by a professional management company. One of the most unique things that I think has happened is, you know, the top nine as far as size in when it comes to golf management companies are companies that are either publicly traded or they have private equity money that has invested in these firms, right? Yeah. And I think that adds a unique layer to sort of the largest golf management companies out there. And then you get down into sort of like the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th largest companies. They're all privately owned in about 50 units like Great Life Golf. So, you know, companies that can pivot a little bit quicker. And so it'll be interesting to see how the management landscape, you know, sort of settles out over the next 5 to 6 years. And then, you know, as far as valuations of golf courses, I mean, if you're a golf course that is, you know, not making money or losing money, you know, you're probably trading for about 1x revenue, roughly. And if you're a golf course that's making substantial money, you're probably trading about 6x your EBITDA, which those numbers, you know, have been pretty consistent for the most part over the last 5 years or so. So the valuation numbers, even though the interest rate environment has gone up, they've held pretty strong still.
Yeah.
But that's the landscape. That's a pretty deep answer. Was that
no,
too much?
No, that was awesome. That was awesome. I mean, it depends on who's listening, if they can track with all of it, right? But there will be some people that can track with that for sure. So so how about future Great Life Golf? Kind of want to hear about what you guys kind of have planned. And
Yeah.
I know it's, I mean, as long as I've known you, there's always been action going on.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But I wonder if there's going to be a time where you just kind of settle down a little bit.
I tell myself that.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Yeah. Acquisition is where we're focused right now, you know? So, we added our first two properties in January this year and then February of this year. So those have come on. We're excited about those real estate investments. And then obviously we're going to third party manage those with our management company. So the six owners of the management company own the real estate, and obviously the management company is going to operate them. We feel good about those opportunities. We're looking for similar opportunities in the marketplace. We're obviously well capitalized collectively as a group now with the merger. with Great Life and Brown Golf coming together so we can take advantage of opportunities. But they've got to be the right opportunities. I mean, a self-sustaining golf asset is a positive influence to golf course owners, to the employees, and to the community. And one that struggles is a detriment to the golf yeah. course owner, the employees, and the community. So, like, it's very important for us to find deals that we believe in that have that long-term opportunity. And there's still probably, unfortunately, you know, 10 to 15% of the market that is going to fall sort of underneath that ability to self-sustain still.
Yeah. And are those opportunities that you're interested in looking at, or are you more so interested in a golf course that's kind of sustaining itself and then you can make it a little bit better?
Well, I think you got to look at top line revenues. There's a minimum threshold of about $1.6 million on 18 holes, I'd say,
yeah.
that you have to hit for it to have an opportunity to self-sustain. I think our real opportunity window is sort of that $1.6 million to $4 million. And maybe it's breaking even, but with our operational game plan, we know we can make it work and it could throw off some profits and reinvest. And I think that's our, you know, that's our real golden opportunity in the future.
Okay. Well, I kind of want to wind this down, but something that I want to talk about that I think is one of the more meaningful things that I've seen, especially, you know, the amount of, you know, golf course companies that I've worked with, it's so easy to get just very embedded in your day-to-day golf course operation that you kind of forget to back out a little bit. And it doesn't mean you're not, you know, great at what you do, but what you guys, it was Great Life Cares.
Great Life Gives.
Great Life Gives. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell the story around that because it was really meaningful for me. And I haven't seen a whole lot of golf organizations do that.
Yeah, it's the philanthropic arm of Great Life Golf. You know, Teresa, who's our HR director, and I have been talking about, you know, how we evolved that side of our business. It was an area that, you know, we didn't really have a focus or commitment to. And I think a lot of what you're saying holds true. You know, you get busy in your day-to-day business, yeah. trying to make a business work. And we sort of got to a point where, you know, our business was operating pretty efficiently. And it was time to commit to something that might be a little bit, you know, larger and more impactful in the marketplace. And she, to her credit, challenged me in the sense that she said, I feel like we need to pick something that maybe is connected to you to some degree. And I was of the mindset that I didn't want to just, you know, donate my money to an organization and kind of put the burden on the organization to, you know, figure out how the funds were deployed, that, you know, we wanted to really have some involvement in that to make sure it went somewhere impactful. And ultimately, what we did is we raised money inside Great Life Gives through in 2023 through on course competitions that we held. And we raised $15,000 collectively as a company through those different competitions. And then we reached out to the different markets that our clubs were in, and we were looking for stories about single parents that were impacted by death or divorce and, you know, their situation, and ultimately went through a process and evaluated all the nominations and selected one single parent to donate the money to. And we went out to Lenexa, Kansas, and presented an offering from the Great Life Gives Fund to a single parent who had, you know, a one-year-old whose husband passed away right before the baby was born. And, yeah, it made a world of difference. And we really feel like it was the right program for us. And we're going to continue that forward in 2024. Little changes as far as how we're going to raise the money. We've involved some charity golf tournaments, and we're going to have Midwest presence and East Coast presence, but we're going to continue it forward for sure.
That's cool, man. Well, I'd love to help out anyway. But it makes me think, you know, I've gotten to know a lot of people in the golf business and a lot of really valuable relationships that I have that I'm really thankful for. And you're certainly a top there. And I think from you're an entrepreneur, you're a leader that has a lot of energy. You're not scared to make some decisions to grow, but you've got this humility about you that allows you to listen to somebody like Teresa and say, yeah, that's something we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so just kudos, man. And I don't know, you have any kind of last things you want to leave us with at all?
This has been a great conversation.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you don't get the opportunity to kind of talk about sort of the personal road too often.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about the business road, but, I'm thankful for the position that I'm in inside Great Life, and I wouldn't be there without the depth of the employees we have.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're special people. So, excited to see what we can do moving forward. And, you know, the same ability to kind of tackle, maybe some things in the industry that we don't totally believe in head on, that exists throughout the company. And there's
yeah.
a lot of people that have helped us get to the point we're at.
Yeah, they believe in it. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, man. I really appreciate you taking
yeah,
the time.
My pleasure.
And welcome to the excellence culture.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, cool.
Great talking with you.